I want to put on record and lodge a complaint that Honorable Slav is eating all the fruits. He came here with no regard to the smaller party. I saw him load his plate twice and eat there. Him and this lady here, I don't know where she's from. And at the college of the IRC supports me on this.
I need to face you, then I can
the fruit. And this is not, I know you picked him up in because he named and shamed me in the house.
No, not because of that.
But I heard him apologize.
Hey?
I heard him. He's only thinking you're going to hear it all now.
Honourable members, I'm sure the others are just grabbing their keys and I'm worried.
There's no one outside
there. Then we'll have to start then. But I'm even sorry about starting so late. I came here too early and we need to check time. Can I welcome everyone with no agenda in front of us, that is a written and a formal agenda for whatever reason. However, formalities first. The apologies I have in front of me are from Honorable Khadebe, Honorable Tinto, and Honorable Freeling. The Deputy Minister and the Director General have also submitted their apologies. That's all that we have for the moment. Is there any other apology? None. Okay, thank you. Honorable members, let me welcome the department as well as the delegates from SALGA as well. And PMG and whoever else for the state. The purpose of our meeting today is to make a start, I'll call it that way, to look at post-RAD scenario. In particular, the distribution and transmission of electricity after the RAD's program has been withdrawn. And the dissolution of the EDI holdings. Also, at the end, we will just be formally submitting the first draft of the strategic plan after we had the strategic plan on the 3rd week of April. Obviously, that's for members to take back home and to their parties that help make inputs so that we can finalize the strategic plan around the middle of next month, hopefully. And our target would be the 14th of June. Coming back to the electricity distribution, quite a number of parties did make reference to this matter, even at the budget vote debate. And even before, in our planning, we have been seized about the matter of ensuring that as a legislator, we also make a contribution towards ensuring that the current challenges around distribution of electricity and by at both national and municipal level are addressed. Hence the invitation of the two spheres of government. So we have then invited the department as well as SALGA to make their inputs on this. I just want to highlight, I really would appeal that let's not look at this meeting as sort of the alpha and omega. At this stage in time, it's more of an eye-opening. Of course, to me, probably members may have been exposed or may have had presentations in the past, but for now, one can even confidently say that we are formally preparing ourselves that we are entering this complex and arduous process up until it is brought to a conclusion in a couple of years' time. Because I dare say it's not going to be a short and, you know, fast road. It's going to be a long, arduous, and slow road. Without further ado, can I invite the Department of Energy delegate to make his presentation on this matter? Thank you very much.
Honorable Chair, honorable members of the Portfolio Committee, my name is Ompia Pani from the Department of Energy, and I will be doing the presentation in collaboration with my colleague, Tavang Godet. Without wasting any time, Chairman, the presentation covers these issues as indicated. Firstly, we'll do an industry overview. We'll indicate some of the industry problems as we see them in relation to the current state of the electricity distribution industry, the EDI. We will also reflect on some of the identified red flags. We will also indicate how to address those and a phased approach. There are those that are immediate interventions that need to be made. We'll touch on those. Particular will address the issue of the maintenance backlogs and also the rehabilitation of some of the infrastructure, and will propose a way forward. Maybe before I go into this slide, to take you back to the EDI restructuring blueprint in 2003, it was adopted by Cabinet, in terms of which structurally we were going to restructure the electricity supply industry. On the distribution side, it would be constituted by the REDs. Six of them were proposed on some basis, on a wall-to-wall basis, trying to maximize economies of scale, anchored by the metros and so on. At the same time, we were going to deal with the matter of the supply side. At that point, on the agenda was the restructuring of ESCOM into three clusters, one of which would have been, or in fact not one of which, but all of which would have been included a component of BEE, Black Economic Empowerment, ultimately leading to full competition on the supply side, in other words, the privatization of certain components of ESCOM and so on. And that would also work on the basis of a deregulated market. In other words, where, as opposed to us setting tariffs like we do currently, we would have had a so-called day-ahead market like you find in Western Europe and other places. The events in California changed all of that. The World Bank also advised against that. But I think more significantly is that South Africa, I believe at that time, prudently recognized that our industry was not yet in a position to accommodate such changes, and a number of reversals happened. In 2005, the elections, what happened is that the decision was reversed on the supply side. However, on the distribution side, we proceeded with the REDS process. This just gives you a sense just how far back this REDS decision goes back. I'll give you some more detail around that. But just also that we put it into context, I'm talking about the supply side, I mean the power station, which is the side, the generation aspect. Then you have the freeway, which is the wires or the transmission lines, usually the big ones, and I apologize if you can't see from there, usually the big ones, and then the small ones. Small ones would be the distribution lines that take it to the end user. And when we talk about distribution, we talk about all of this in this box. So it's the freeway, the wires, including the substations, and then the cables that take you into the household or into the factory and so on. Just to also indicate, Tavan, before you do that, that this is largely controlled by municipalities, from a customer perspective, and ESCOM from an asset-based perspective. I think that there is a ratio. So in other words, between ESCOM and municipalities, they share customers and revenues. ESCOM takes 60% of the revenues and 40% of the customers. Municipalities, the other way around. If you can carry on, tell us. Just some numbers, just so that you can put it into some perspective. And this goes back perhaps 5 years. So, colors, like we might be out by a factor of 10 billion or so. But by and large, the distribution industry has revenues of 40 billion rand with 9.2 million customers, 4.5 million on the ESCOM side, and the balance on the municipal side. Some 31,000 people are employed within ESCOM distribution and municipal utilities. The asset value in 2008 from a replacement perspective is about 260 billion rand. And the amount of energy that is purchased is 224,000 gigawatt hours. And the length of the distribution lines and cables are as indicated. Significantly is that the average age of the assets that we're talking about here, the average age is 45 years. Now, this is not a very healthy state of affairs in terms of the average asset life. So basically what it means is that if you take the new ones, right, which would be a significant proportion of that, it is still dominated by the old ones. And that's why your average comes to 45 years. As we speak today, the EDI is not in a manner, is not structured in a manner to support some of our aspirations as a country, being economic growth and to provide customers with a reliable supply. So it was a problem then, it still is a problem today. Cabinet had then decided in 2003, as I indicated, to deal with the matter through a particular process, the REDS process, and it has now become evident, you know, after persistent attempts to try and find a workable model, that we cannot continue with the EDI blueprint as contemplated. If you recall the EDI blueprint, just so that we can get some more detail, is that it contemplated transferring assets from ESCOM and municipalities into new public entities called the REITs. And if we could carry on, last year in December, Cabinet reversed that decision, which meant that by the end of March this year, EDI Holdings, the project management company established to project manage the REITs, would cease operations, and that the department was then tasked with the asset rehabilitation mandate, more directly than through a project management company. However, notwithstanding the cabinet decision, it doesn't mean that the problems have disappeared. The problems still are there, and consequently we need to have a national intervention, which is part of what we are proposing in the way and the way forward. Just to also indicate that it is a massive financial investment that is required in order to mitigate the risk of power failure. Sometimes when there is load shedding, it's very understandable that the supply side is short, but in other instances, even when the supply side is adequate, it is the distribution side that fails the customer, so to speak. Now, we also reflect on some of the fundamental problems that, you know, afflict the industry. I think the issue of tariffs and the vast ranges in cost recovery through these tariffs is a bigger problem than the structure, as you can appreciate. So in other words, the way that we collect money from the different customers is something that needs to be looked upon very, very seriously. To give an example, there's a place in Ekuruleni that's separated by a main road, and the two companies, this is an existing example, a live example, you can put it that way, two companies both in the air manufacturing business, and what happens is that the one is an Eskom customer, the other is a municipal customer, and the tariff differential between the two companies across the road is 40%, which means the one has an input cost which is 40% higher for exactly the same a utility. That's a history issue, and we're saying that without addressing those issues around tariffs, we would not have done justice to this. Then the service standards and practices, I think maybe here to flag a specific issue that relates to the provision of free basic services, the standards are different. So depending where you find yourself, municipality A or municipality B, it would be a different cost structure, it would be a different size or package of free basic services, a basket of free basic services that you would receive. In fairness to municipalities, I think also the honorable members to also indicate that the constitution, Schedule 4B of the constitution, prescribes what services are municipal mandates and so on. And you know, it's not so much, you're not trying to say that it's a municipal problem or municipal mistake. It stems from the structure of our legal system as well as to their prerogative to provide the different service standards and so on. We've dealt with the issue of appropriate investment in the assets, but I think by and large what's happened is that now we're seeing an unacceptable deterioration in the quality and reliability of the distribution. And Chair, we indicated that on the supply side, we have recognized that it's a problem. We're building power stations, we're spending billions of rands, hundreds of billions literally, to deal with that. But in terms of the last leg in the value chain, if we do not deal with the issue of reliability, it manifests as those, you know, service delivery problems that we have seen recently. The issue of skills development for the industry, we have done some analysis. The average age of your electricity technical staff responsible for looking after the networks and all of that is almost retirement age. So in other words, within the next five years, most of those people that we rely on to look after the networks will be retired. And the question becomes, are we creating more opportunity, the pipeline, to bring more skill into the sector and so on. Maybe just lastly on the skill side is that we also find a very strange distribution of the skills that, and I think it's also natural that people want to migrate to certain urban and other centers rather than other places. So what you find is that the municipality out there will be expected to provide a service at the same level as the Johannesburgs, and yet we're not able to draw the necessary skills to those areas. So apart from a shortage in the skill, it's also a distribution in the skill itself. I've mentioned the issue of free basic electricity and free basic alternative energy. Chair, we take this one very, very seriously because we believe that we have a responsibility in terms of cushioning the poor and the indigent, and the way that we do that is we provide free basic services, in this case free basic electricity and free basic alternative energy. And we're saying that more than 70% of indigent households are receiving free basic electricity, and about 5% are receiving the alternative. So the 5% is those that are not necessarily connected to the grid in more rural areas. And Chair, if you don't continue doing that, then your poverty cushion, your poverty net gets compromised. I think the consequences are not debatable, Chair. And again, the context is that as we increase the electricity tariff towards what we believe is the is an appropriate, economically sustainable level, it becomes important that we do not lose sight of the impact on the poor, and therefore free basic services become critical. Now that is being done by municipalities, and in the context that, you know, there are certain limitations in funds and so on, you know, that we must keep alive this issue of the dispense, the way that we dispense free basic electricity. Some of the issues that municipalities will raise, for example, it's an administrative one where they say we do not have registers of who qualifies and who does not. The long and short of it, Chair, is that the leakage in free basic electricity is very huge, and you know, the question becomes one of financial sustainability of the whole project. Then there's the issue about the, you know, you can imagine if we're struggling to rehabilitate the infrastructure, what happens about the capital costs? Who funds the capital costs to provide these targeted communities which qualify for free basic alternative services? We provide in those areas, for example, things like gas stoves with paraffin and ethanol gel, LP gas, and so on. And there is some transaction cost that gets incurred, in terms of which, if the people do not collect the tokens because of lack of infrastructure, then your whole free basic energy program gets compromised. Again, you indicate that it's also an unconditional grant that is given to municipalities. It's also important that municipalities must also use that money for the intended purpose, and unconditional grant notwithstanding. There is also a practice in terms of which some municipalities provide top-up funding for free basic electricity and free basic alternative energy to the extent that they can afford. And, you know, where municipal funding is deployed in that particular way, it's very important that it must be precise in its targeting so that you don't have the leakages. Now, Chair, we're raising these issues because ultimately you will see, you know, throughout our presentation, is that it boils down to the ability to finance all of these things. You know, so if you're not able to finance your network rehabilitation or your network maintenance, if you're not able to fund your free basic energy provision and a whole lot of other expectations, then what happens is that we end up in this vicious cycle where we find ourselves right now. And that's what we're trying to address. If you carry on, Taban, to the next slide. What we have done in order to, you know, to get closer to the problem, to understand it beyond just the theoretical, is that there have been some inspections and some visits and some assessment of certain cities. 12 priority cities, we call them, not necessarily because they're more important, but simply because they happen to have to carry South Africa's economic activity. What also happened is that prior to the 2010 World Cup, we did an assessment of all the host cities as well in relation to this matter, focused on asset management strategies and plans, you know, to deal with the issue of municipal electricity distribution. We also reflected on some of the practices by ESCOM itself on the distribution side. You know, we mustn't forget, as I indicated, ESCOM is also responsible for some 4.5 million customers, primarily in the rural areas. And the assessment showed that municipalities and ESCOM are not providing sufficient investment in the thing. I mean, sometimes we come to the portfolio committee and we feel about how we provide electricity in the electrification program, but the slightest wind and so on, bad weather, and the networks, you know, are disrupted and so on. It's a function of some of these issues that we're raising today. We mentioned the issue of the average age. You know, the law of averages must indicate to you if something has an average of 40, and we're saying that, for example, in Johannesburg, in certain parts of Johannesburg, there's infrastructure that goes back to the 1930s. You know, it tells you just what kind of problem we are facing if we do not address that. Okay, sorry, maybe on this, that the other point that we're making here is that we also need to put this into context, is that all of this is happening parallel to us wanting to grow the economy, and sometimes the economy responding positively and all of that. So it's like we have certain contradictions. We're growing the economy, but we're not making the necessary infrastructural investments to sustain the economic growth. We have dealt with the issue of disruptions, the quality of service is declining. We don't have to convince you. We track the number of outages in specific areas as well, and it's increasing with the number of power disruptions. And as I indicated, sometimes, you know, you get to hear that it's load shedding, whereas it might not be load shedding. In other instances, you get to hear that it's cable theft when it's not cable theft. So, you know, it becomes very tricky as to exactly what happens in that space. The sum total is that the regulatory environment, which is the provisions of the Electricity Regulation Act and the provisions under the Electricity Regulation Amendment Act, are not sufficient and conducive for enforcing some of the license conditions on the distributors. In fact, Chair, on this one is that we have a very unfortunate dual regulatory system in this country. The one being the regulator itself, NERSA, but concurrent with that is a Schedule 4B mandate on municipalities. So municipalities regulate themselves insofar as this service provision is concerned. It's called electricity regulation, but at the same time, they're supposed to be regulated by NERSA. And where those two, you know, coincide or deviate, it becomes very tricky as to which way it goes. And in fact, a live example is in relation to tariff setting. So NERSA sets tariffs, and you would see, I think last week in the newspaper, NERSA published another paper or an invite in relation to those municipalities that want to increase tariffs beyond what has been prescribed, because NERSA recognizes that, you know, their jurisdiction ends at a certain point, and ultimately municipalities can go beyond that. And Chair, again, it's not pointing any fingers at municipalities, it's a constitutional dispensation. It's the fact that municipalities provide a whole lot more services and they need revenues, and unfortunately the utilities are where they go to try and find those utilities, I mean, those extra revenues. As in terms of how we think and that we need to deal with this particular issue beyond the cabinet decision of 2010, is that our focus now is not so much on the structure of the industry. So in other words, we are not going to focus, or rather we're going to defocus from the rates process. We're going to be focused a lot more on the regulatory issues as indicated here. And those regulatory issues relate to perhaps not in sequence or in order, but the maintenance backlogs. Some of the infrastructure is beyond maintenance. It needs to be rehabilitated. And then there's also a program in relation to certain investments that need to be made. It's not maintenance, it's not rehabilitation. It's what we call strengthening. For example, the incident that I referred to, where if there is bad weather, you know, the networks fail. That's like a strengthening kind of issue that we're talking about. And we do that through a program that we call Project ADAM, an approach to distribution asset management. Just to also indicate, Chair, that this program is not a new issue at all. I mean, EDI Holdings had already done some groundwork in relation to some of those things, and what we are proposing to do post the cabinet decision is to locate it within the department as a major program and to proceed with it, but also borrowing from the work that was done just around the the World Cup. This slide indicates the different, if you like, geographical areas of the country at a very high level and the extent of the backlog. So in other words, when we say there's about 30 billion rand that is required in order to do that, you know, in the previous rates dispensation, remember there would be six rates, so there would have been, you know, one rate, this would have been another rate, and so on, is that you can see the number of, or the amount of funding that is required in order to deal with this. And Chair, maybe to also indicate at this point that in the context of the IRP and the build program for power stations, this is a drop in the ocean. And we're spending hundreds of billions in this area here, Nidupi, and then somewhere here in Kusile, between the two of them, it's almost 300 billion rand that we're spending. Chair, it would be foolhardy to spend 300 billion on that and not spend this 30 billion in order to complete the loop. And we also give a breakdown there as to what is required. This was in 2008. Obviously, it needs to be updated. We think that it's increasing at a rate of about 2% per annum is the problem. So this money would have been perhaps now increased to 35 billion or thereabouts. But I think the scale is what we are trying to reflect here. We give a graphic illustration of some of the problems. It's everything from safety to, you know, I don't know what you can call it. I mean, this kind of situation here indicates that this room has not been visited. I mean, just basic cleanliness and making sure that, you know, you look after the interest. This is the kind of problem that we did. So, Tama, we're not going to dwell into that here. If you can just carry on around that. So, what has happened is that we've taken a snapshot. We know where the problems are on the basis of the priority and municipalities, as we call them, including the host cities of the World Cup. So, it's almost like we have a picture around 18 and municipalities, and we're saying that unless something is done, it puts the country at risk of deepening the electricity crisis, and as such, we need to run a parallel process as we build the power station in order to do that. And therefore, a business plan was put together, which we call Project Adam, to try and deal with that particular matter. A little bit of detail, Chair, and I apologize you can't see this, but basically we're saying that the business plan development has been completed, which is phase one of our attempt to address the problem. And then in phase two, which is where we find ourselves, we need to make certain critical short-term interventions at various areas. NERSA also did an audit, I think, post a big incident at City Power. NERSA then did their own assessment and audit, and we held a maintenance summit about 3 years ago, around the distribution issues. But now we're saying we need to take it even further and try and get to a holistic program that not only deals with the maintenance and rehabilitation issues, having done the audit, but also deals with the matter that is equally important, which is the human capital aspect of it. Because if you don't do that, if you make the intervention, is our argument, 5 years down the line, you're going to end up at the same point, unless additional, you know, holistic interventions are made. And then in the last phase, let's not say the last phase, but in the third phase, the final phase, we intend to implement a national rehabilitation refurbishment program, you know, spanning all municipalities. As to the design and the financing of it, Chair, we're looking at a number of options. If I can maybe just quickly reflect on that. As to the design, we think that it would be an extremely conditional funding that would be made available from the national. We're saying extremely conditional because we're wanting to make sure that the rest of the other complementary problems, if there is such a word, I mean, the problems that go together with the asset rehabilitation, those problems need to be terms of how it's going to be financed, we're looking at a number of streams. We've had very positive interactions with both National Treasury and the development financial institutions, both locally. The World Bank itself is also very keen through National Treasury to participate in the whole program. But we're also looking, Chair, at the electricity tariff, and I gave some context there, that it's almost like a 30 billion in 1 trillion rand kind of argument, and we believe that it's insignificant in the scheme of things. I'm not trying to underplay, you know, the impact this will have on the tariff, but I think in the context that, you know, we're spending a trillion rand on the power stations, we believe we can do that as well. And then obviously a combination of both tariff and fiscal and debt and so forth. That's where we find ourselves. So in terms of where we would like to find ourselves, we call it phase two, but that's like now, you know, is that we believe that with these municipalities that have been identified, which is not a complete list, by the way, this is at that point, that we believe that we can make certain interventions along maintenance, rehabilitation, and strengthening to the tune of about 2 billion rand. It will be on the basis of the identified critical infrastructure, and we're hoping to kickstart that immediately. Maybe to also indicate, Chair, that there was some funding that was made available through the tariff about 4 years ago by NERSA, some 1.4 billion rand. There is still some of that funding that is available, so we believe that even though we don't have the 2 billion already, that we can make an immediate start to this through piloting and so on. I think we have touched on the funding, and ultimately it's about 30 billion rand over the different phases. We can just carry on there. We're saying that in relation to the financial year 2011-12, we find ourselves at phase two, where we would like to pilot some of these initiatives elsewhere. So maybe to also, it's not on the slide at all, sorry, no, it's on point number three, to perhaps go to point number three, is that we do not see this as a Department of Energy program alone. We regard it as being a very significant, if you like, municipal service delivery / finance, financial sustainability kind of program, and it requires the participation of all the key stakeholders, and I'm glad that Salga is here today, but the Department of Corporate Governance and Traditional Affairs, National Treasury, even the Department of Economic Development, and so on. We did not go to town chair, we just focused this on the electricity aspect. But you can also imagine the socioeconomic impact of this, and the number of jobs that could be created through the maintenance program and so on, because this is something that is going to proceed for some time yet. And we're saying that the number of regulatory issues that also need to be dealt with, we have already indicated to you, Chair, that we would like to bring some amendments to the Electricity Regulation Act to try and make sure that, you know, we improve the regulatory environment as it relates to the distribution sector, and that goes hand in hand with that. Maybe what we did not also indicate here is that there is also the human capital aspect of it, and Chair, there we're seeking partnerships with the necessary interventions through education and so on, to make sure that ultimately we build the capacity. Yeah. Thank you very much for leaving.
Thank you very much. For our members, I would suggest we quickly move to Salga. I've observed that we are taking notes so that when we start our questions and comments, we have had a full picture of the presentation. Over to Salga now. Thank you.
by the Department of Energy, there's quite a lot of issues raised, some of which we have not covered, but I'm sure honorable members will want also to get a perspective from SAGA as to how we see some of those things. We will rely on questions to deal with those. I'll just focus on what we had prepared in terms of the brief. I think one would like to start by indicating that from the point of view of local government, over the years, up until latest being 2009, local government has been acknowledging that there are problems in the electricity distribution industry. And for that reason, they committed themselves to participating in the restructuring of the industry, precisely to address those problems. From our point of view, there were four main problems, and those continue to exist, and I'll talk more about that. The first one is what we call misalignment between the electricity distribution industry and the current architecture of the local government fiscal framework, which from the local government point of view is quite important, and in many cases, I think it's one of the key contributors to some of the problems that we experience. The second one is the high inefficiency owing to fragmentation, where you have 178 distributors in the country of different sizes. We acknowledge that as a problem and continues to be a challenge for us. Inability to leverage economies of scale in respect of investing in assets, sharing of facilities and services and people development. We acknowledge that as an issue of local government. And consequently, inequitable treatment of consumers across the country. I think the example that my colleague Ombi made of companies in Egorulen is a telling example. Probably there are worse cases of that. In that, NERSA would approve, based on the assessment of the finances of a particular distributor, a particular tariff that is appropriate for that distributor to be financially viable. But because of the consumer base of that particular distributor, that tariff may not be comparable with another distributor. Just to make the example more clear, let's take Mbizana Municipality, which is also a licensed distributor in town in Mbizana. Pretty much most of its consumers, about 85% of them, are indigent and have to be subsidized from the tariff. Mbizana, for Mbizana to be sustainable, it means that Mbizana has to charge a whole lot more from the remaining 10% for it to be able to be sustainable, while it cross-subsidizes the 90% that is not able to pay. So that's a typical case, and therefore you have Eskom, which is collecting revenues from consumers that are relatively wealthier in town, your key industrial customers and so on and so on, having a much more better base for it to cross-subsidize, and therefore doesn't have to charge as much from businesses in order to be sustainable in providing to the poor that they're providing to. So all of that is in the structure of the industry leading to that. But I think I need to talk a little bit more about this architecture that I'm talking about of the industry and this misalignment with the financial framework or fiscal framework of municipalities. Municipalities in general, I'm going to talk about this overall picture here, of municipalities in which 90% of the revenue of municipalities is supposed to come from local own revenue, that is revenue paid in by consumers who are in that particular municipal area. And 10% of it comes from the national fiscal in the form of equitable share and MIG. Now, that 90% is basically essentially made up of property rates and electricity distribution income. The other trading service, which is water, across the country, you find that at best is a break-even or is itself subsidized by rates income, or in addition by electricity revenue income, because
going to be difficult to price it appropriately, given that it's a basic service that households need to have. So electricity distributor then becomes a key contributor to income, to the 90% that municipalities are supposed to collect on their own in order for them to distribute or to provide services. They have 38 functions in terms of the constitution, and they rely on that, just on these two, to be able to finance 38 functions. So it's a bigger problem of the financial framework or municipal framework. Now, linked to this is that a significant portion then of the electricity distribution income accrues to Eskom, who provides 40% of the consumer and collects 50% of the industry's income. And that revenue accrued to Eskom doesn't come to municipalities. It ends there. So with that construct of municipalities having are supposed to rely on electricity to generate revenue, then you have a situation where in other parts of the country those municipalities are not able to take any revenue benefit from the industry. It becomes a problem. I think linked to that is that key industrial customers in the main are customers of Eskom, and in areas that are medium and smaller size municipalities, to add to that, they are not licensed to be distributors. So the whole revenue that links to industry, key industrial customers, and in areas of medium size and small municipalities, this supposed revenue base of municipalities is not accrued to municipalities. So in a sense, the point we are making that this whole then architecture of the electricity distribution industry then doesn't talk to certainly the architecture of the distribution industry doesn't talk to the framework, the fiscal framework of local government financing, but at the same time, the whole overall framework of local government financing put a burden on the industry. So it's two points really that we're trying to make there. The one link to that is ability then of municipalities to exercise the function of being service authority over Eskom, where Eskom is a provider in the small and medium-sized municipalities. Eskom sees itself as an authority on its own. It sees itself being accountable to NERSA in terms of provision of services. And therefore, municipalities are not able to influence Eskom. Eskom, in fact, in our meetings with them, they completely refused to sign service level agreements with municipalities in areas where Eskom is a provider in municipal areas. So then municipalities are not able to account to consumers or to communities about what Eskom does or does not do in their areas, because Eskom says we have a different way of accountability that does not link back to you as a municipality. So again, it then compromises the what we can call the authority of a local government to govern in its area of responsibility, and in particular in its area of in one of the powers and functions of a municipality, which is electricity distribution, which then consumers, when that happens, they see municipalities failing them as opposed to Eskom. And in many ways, it then also expresses this. This also expresses itself by way of municipalities having plans that are prioritizing particular areas as nodes of development, and Eskom has its own plans in terms of infrastructure development. So we saw this as a critical element that we thought needs to be addressed as part of the restructuring, and therefore it remains, as I'm saying, a problem to the extent that we have never really restructured the industry. Now, talking about the investment in infrastructure, from the point of view of municipalities, we believe that during the long period of uncertainty regarding the future of the distribution assets, we have experienced a situation where there's been a significant underinvestment in infrastructure by municipalities. Of course, one would say also other services will also experience significant underinvestment as to what is required. I think we want to divide this into two. The first part of it is that 1994, when the new, or 2000, let's say, effectively 2000, when the new municipalities were established in their current form, there were huge imbalances in terms of access to services. And the country, correctly so, decided that to the extent that the available infrastructure was servicing the minority of South African citizens, there is a need to focus pretty much on a drive to extend services to those who were not served. And by so doing, prioritizing extending services, it meant that rehabilitation and maintenance of infrastructure that was already there, that was 20 years old even at that time, on average in some of the cases, that infrastructure then was neglected to an extent. We have done well, we have statistics that show we have done well in terms of coverage, in terms of access to services, but then the infrastructure maintenance and refurbishment has suffered as a consequence of that. So there's that part across the board in all infrastructure services that are a responsibility of local government and of the country, I would argue, whether taking to trains and everything. So there is that challenge. Then linked to that, then there becomes this uncertainty in respect of the future of the assets of the electricity distribution industry. Then a mayoral committee or council sitting and prioritizing would say, we have a challenge to maintain roads, to maintain water services and so on. Why don't we prioritize the little that we have in water and roads as opposed to this uncertain component, which is electricity? Consequently, this has led to the ballooning of the backlog. And I think the Department of Energy has talked to this, that by 2008, there was generally agreement across the board that we had about 27 billion of backlog in terms of maintenance that we needed to take care of. Now, what we are saying, I think, which is where we are agreeing with the department, is that it may not be feasible to finance this backlog from tariffs. That brings me to the other part of the fiscal framework of local government that needs to be dealt with. Electricity and water in South Africa is expected to self-finance itself in a way from tariffs. We have done research in water, and it's proven that we are quickly getting to a point where our prices of water, even low as they are beginning to put us in a position where, as an economy, we will not be able to compete because of the price of administrative services. If we're to do that with electricity, say, this 27 billion backlog and above must be financed completely from the tariff, then we are going to face a problem where we have to increase tariffs in a way that will make services unaffordable to the users and undermine the economy or the growth of the economy of the country. So there is a need for an intervention that seeks to find a way as a country collective instead of individual municipalities to contribute in securing funding to provide for this particular financing of this backlog. That's a principal issue that we are raising. But at a practical level, anyway, most of the municipalities do not have the financials to support them borrowing as much as they are required to borrow anyway. Even if we were to say we insist that municipalities must borrow and foot the bill of this 27 billion, very few of them will be able to go out into the market and be able to raise that. So clearly there is a need, and we feel that SALCA, Department of Energy, and National Treasury need to work together in this regard to develop strategies to address the challenge. But that challenge now must be addressed as part of the way forward in respect of creating a sustainable industry, instead of just us fixing the problem of the 27 billion. But let's look at how don't we create a similar problem again in 10 years' time. I think that would be the issue. I want to move on to an area of distribution price regulation. You will know, honourable members, that because electricity prices have been increasing, the debate about how to protect the poor against high electricity costs become much more important and in 2010 last year, NERSA required ESCOM to implement inclining block tariffs to all conventionally metered domestic consumers, and it later required the same for all domestic consumers to be charged in terms of an inclining block tariff. However, this when you say all domestic consumers, now it means those ones that are provided by municipalities now have to be charged in terms of an inclined block tariff. But then in the way it was constructed, there were concerns, even though as local government we commend NERSA in terms of its efforts to provide relief to low usage consumers, we do feel that there are certain things that could have been done better, which we think can still be corrected going forward. The first one, in our view, is that pretty much in designing the inclining block tariff, NERSA relied on ESCOM data and modeled this according to ESCOM data, and then said we can then roll this out to all consumers. But this data is not relevant to individual municipalities in terms of the combination of in terms of the distribution of consumer income. Which then has become a problem. In addition, in proposing this inclining block tariff, NERSA removed what we saw initially as capacity related signals, to say that to the extent that we need to build this capacity in order to provide, there must be in the charge a way of providing for that. It removed fixed charges, which then presented a revenue risk, especially in towns that are holiday towns, where consumers only come in December and they have availability of supply throughout the year. This was taken out. In the design of it, because it simply said anyone who consumes this much must get a free service, it led to non-poor consumers benefiting from the tariff structure. The leakage that I think my colleague from the department was talking about is in the design of the inclining block tariff as proposed and being implemented by NERSA. So this then has an impact on municipalities. Other things that are related to it is the extent to which basically it was designed according to the red areas as they were proposed in the past, instead of comparing municipalities or groupings of municipalities according to their consumer groups. It would say in municipalities that are in red 1, this is what will happen, and then they set the benchmark. In municipalities that are in red 2 and so on. Instead of saying that municipalities that are similar in character in terms of consumer income distribution, this is what would happen. The effect of that, just taking the case of ESCOM, was that ESCOM, by its own admission and its own submission to NERSA, when they were interacting with NERSA on the matter, they said they had to charge a further 4.6% over and above the average increase for consumers that are not regulated by this inclined block tariff, so that they can be able to cross-subsidize domestic consumers. Now, we can imagine the effect of this. If ESCOM was brought relatively wealthy, key industrial customers, consumer base itself, in order to survive, it had to increase tariffs in a reasonable way for those consumers, but over and above, at another 5%, so as to cross-subsidize. The impact that has on the smaller municipalities is worse. In that, in their case, for them to survive, and I've explained this point, they have to charge a whole lot more from consumers. Even in ESCOM, they are saying, in 5 years' time, if they were to perpetrate this, they will see prices for the high consumers to being much more unaffordable, and the impact on the economy. And I'm sure everyone can imagine that. Without going into details in terms of ESCOM being able to hedge this, in a typical case of a municipality, we took a metro here to look at what has been the impact of this on municipalities in this financial year. In the case of that metro that we're looking at, the loss from the domestic revenue as a result of this incoming block tariff was about 25%, which is huge for a municipality. The loss of the percentage of total revenue that the municipality was getting as a result of it starting from this year in implementing this incoming block tariff was about 10%. And we've compared this again against non-domestic tariffs, that from the the amount of this income compared to non-domestic tariff again was about a quarter of the non-domestic tariff. We have tried to engage with NERSA about this because we believe that it immediately impacts on the viability, financial viability of municipalities going forward. As I said, electricity, when you cut 25% or cut 10% from the electricity income, you are cutting a significant portion of the 90% that municipalities must raise locally, and therefore you undermine their financial viability. The effect of it is that with them then having to face almost across the country having to face deficits in their budget, they then prioritize payments differently. It's likely that the municipality will use whatever money it has to pay its employees as opposed to paying water boards or paying ESCOM, and then the whole thing then rolls back again back to the bulk provider being ESCOM in part. The other issue that we just want to raise, which we think is an issue that needs attention, is electricity theft that we've partnered with ESCOM to start to implement a program to respond to. Just to indicate numbers, that in the last financial year, Cape Town and Joburg indicated losses of about 121 million to 50 million worth of electricity to illegal electricity connections and theft. It's an area that we think we cannot, as we're trying to solve our problems, forget about, because it's a drain on the income of the municipality in this very critical service. The other part, just quickly trying to come towards the end, is the integrated national electrification program. There are issues there that we want to highlight. Firstly, cases where municipalities find themselves having to implement the INEP project in areas where ESCOM is a distributor, which stretches the capacity of municipalities. But because there is a demand to do these things and there is a misalignment between terms of ESCOM and terms of municipalities then have to act in this. We see this program as one of the key ways of dealing with electricity theft, and therefore it's not something that we can just, it links back to saying those that who are poor and need access to energy must be provided energy so that we can identify those who are stealing energy and could afford to pay for energy and deal with them. We have also identified that among some municipalities there is low spending on their allocations, and it's something that we want to raise this with leaders of local government to deal with in their own municipalities as part of the induction program to highlight key areas of focus for them. We also do have now what seems to be a structural problem that links to the skills that my colleague from the department was talking about. We have many cases of distributing municipalities that don't have electrical engineers. And those municipalities now start to rely completely on consultants who are self-interested, would pick and choose what they come to the municipality and motivate for, to say, we can assist you to apply for MIG or for electricity funding on the basis of this. We have done assessment, approved, we found those cases where municipal managers confronted by this to say, please approve this because it will benefit you. And then indeed an application is submitted and is funded. Only to find that if there was somebody who is skilled, who stands on the side of the municipality to assess this, different priorities would have been decided upon as opposed to what comes to the municipality. And at the same time, from the point of view of MIG and even the electricity program itself, there isn't capacity to go and actually inspect, because the assumption is that the municipalities, when they have submitted, they have capacity to inspect these and make sure that the programs are appropriate, and when they are implemented appropriately. So the capacity gap is becoming a huge stopper for municipalities. do, as local government, realize that we do need to take active interest in trying to find, in trying to resolve the problems. Because this is a function of municipalities, and if it's not solved, it will continue to be a burden to municipalities. I think in part, maybe I should jump onto this, to this particular one now, on energy efficiency. We think one of the things that we need to do, given that we have constraints in infrastructure as one problem, but of course, as part of the country's response to climate change, we do need to scale up our investment in energy efficiency, especially in respect of solar water heating. We think that if we could do much on that, while we are solving the problems of infrastructure maintenance, if we can do that, we can relieve part of the constraint. Instead of drawing that limited energy to heat water, try and divert that, at least in the short term, to alternative sources of energy. So to conclude, Chair, we identified four areas that we think we may want to focus on this year. The first one is in relation to developing alternatives to the establishment of RESA's national government energy that was conceptualized, but still find a way to solve the problem of electricity industry inefficiencies and problems that I mentioned earlier on. And I think in conceptualizing that, we do need to make sure that we respond to issues of structural inefficiencies, we respond to issues of financing the backlog and investment needs, we respond to issues of appropriate pricing and equity in pricing across the country. And we do know that some municipalities, even when we do not have the program of RES, are continuing to explore possibilities of establishing a province-wide municipal-owned electricity services delivery vehicle. We see that happening in the Free State, which says that municipalities, even while we're saying that the RES in the way they were constructed were problematic, municipalities are saying that we still do need to find some way of aggregating and coming together in order to improve efficiency. The second point that we think should be a priority in our view is, as I said, is upscaling energy efficiency programs and investment in alternative energy as a temporal relief to capacity constraints, but at the same time as a response to climate change. Thirdly, is intensification of the fight against electricity theft, also as a temporal relief to our constraints, but at the same time to in the long term resolve the issue of the leakage in our center. And lastly, we want to do all of this in a context in which we have new councillors, who most of them may not necessarily understand the industry and the difficulties that the industry has to deal with. So we do think that we need to capacitate these new councillors. It must be one of the major drives for this year, so that they engage and lead appropriately in their municipalities in respect of the industry. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Now, I think it's time for questions. I will take hands for questions. Mama Tivela, Tete Muloto, Professor Ross, Tete Lucas, Tete, in that order.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I've got a few questions for Felga. My first question is about the race. I just wanted to know if why is Felga or the municipalities coming back to the business of race when they were so adamant to the race thing? Because with me, what I think is that when race was first spoken about was that it was going to relieve this smaller municipality. But then, with Salga, Salga couldn't see that. And now I think they opened their eyes now to see that this race thing will help. I wonder, is it going to help to work? Because where Red One was starting, they completely refused to agree with Red. Is it going to work even at Cape Town? And the next one is about also the theft, electricity theft. Is there anything which the municipalities are doing? Because in each municipality, there are ward councillors, there are ward committees to look at the electricity theft, because it's not done in the air. It's on the ground. When you go to the squatter camps here in Cape Town, you find lines on the ground, which are very dangerous, even for the children playing around there, to be caught or die there with those wires on the ground. We've got ward committees and ward councillors and the communities. Who are the eyes of the government? Because those ward committees are people who are being put there. It's a structure of government. Are they trying, or are they ever doing that to look at what's happening there, to help the councillors there? And the last one is about the coupons. I had the presenter talking and complaining a lot about the tariffs and distribution there. But then in the rural areas, most of those areas, they don't pay to municipality electricity. Even the ones who are supposed to get the free basic electricity, they buy coupons. And what happens to the money that they buy, the coupons which they are buying there? Is the money going to the municipality, or is it going to ESCO? Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Chairperson. I've got three questions. Yes. Thank you, Chairperson. I've got three questions directed to Salga. The first one is related to a point that they alluded to on the pricing of water services and solid waste. You have indicated that there are challenges in pricing this service is appropriate. My concern is, if you don't attempt to deal with the problem, it's going to put a lot of strain. It will continue to put a lot of strain on the revenue that you generate from electricity. What are the real challenges that you face in trying to come up with an appropriate tariff for these two services? My second question would be on the free basic electricity. In the submission of Department of Energy, it's been mentioned that one of the challenges that free basic electricity is an unconditional grant, and municipalities tend to use it for other services. The question is, would it not be advisable, and I just want to hear your opinion on that, would it not be advisable to make free basic education, the allocation, a conditional grant?
Thank you,
The last question relates to the concerns that you have on the inclined block tariff. I would assume that you have no problems with the notion of cross-subsidization because it's an established norm, even in tax policy, that the higher you earn, the more you pay, and you essentially you subsidize the poor. I just want to establish that you're going to have a problem with that. The problem that we have is the extent of the weight that, because in our tax system, we are talking about the progressive nature of our tax system. The poor will pay less, but the rich will still pay more. I just want to establish that, whether you have a problem with cross-subsidization, or it's the way, the extent, and to the extent that is done, and the complications that arise from that cross-subsidization. And lastly, what were the responses of NERSA when you interacted with them on the inclined block tariff? Because you are making very good point here. That, for instance, you are saying that, I just want to read from a point which I found to be quite valid. You are saying the NERSA's inclined block tariff structure, one, it removed the previous capacity-related signal. But secondly, the point that I found to be quite important, and I would want to hear what the views of NERSA on that, is to say it does not take into account regulatory and electricity pricing policy requirements regarding higher consumption, consumers paying fixed charges and time of use rate. Those are my questions.
Chairperson, taking the total asset value of
the mic is not on. Can you try that?
Okay.
Thanks, Chair. Just taking the total asset value of our electricity distribution industry, which is 260 billion, and then our backlogs of 27.6 billion and loss on the networks, which ranges between 2 billion and 8 billion a year. I fully agree with Mr. Apani that, you know, 30 billion in terms of a budgetary process is just a drop in the ocean. We need to do it. It's very important that we stop, especially the losses on the network. But now coming to the financing of that 30 billion, and this is my question. You've mentioned the National Treasury would be involved and the World Bank, but just more specifics regarding how we can perhaps finance it. And then also, are we also going to revert back to electricity tariffs? We've seen about 4 times 25% electricity tariff hikes in the last couple of years, I think 3 years. And it's the last straw that breaks the camel's back, and I don't think consumers are ready for that again and again and again. So as far I fully agree with the 30 billion, we need to do the job, but we have to be, I'd just like to be very clear in terms of the funding model that we're going to use. And then just coming to SALGA, yes, it is. I think your funding is inadequate, and I can't see that municipalities, especially with the state of municipalities currently, many municipalities that's dysfunctional can do any maintenance. And then I fully agree also, since 2003 there was a misplaced strategy in terms of EDI and perceptions that EDI will take over the networks. And that brings me to my question, the future of the assets of the distribution industry. Who would actually own these distribution industry in the final analysis? Because perhaps it also has a bearing on the different roles that people, that different departments and different entities will play in maintenance, and who will finally own the assets in terms of that. So defining the different role players, who would be responsible for the maintenance, and I think currently the situation is that municipalities have done very, very little maintenance. In terms of the perhaps integrated, there's an IDP that should just compact over the whole distribution industry or not, or what is expected, because I think that municipalities could not come up to scratch, and since 2003 very, very little maintenance has been done, except in a few cases of municipalities. Let me just check quickly. And you also said not to create the same problems again. I would just like to perhaps have more of a business plan coming from SALGA. How do they see the interaction with all the other entities in terms of doing this maintenance? Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you.
goodie he's getting.
Got a goodie there.
I said, Chairperson, I think one of the things that I think we did take much too long to decide to stop the EDI, because we invested a great deal of money in this year, and it's unfortunate that with this, at this time, then we change it. And then I'm not too sure what's going to happen to the personnel and the assets that have come into it. I think we have to look at this year. However, the concern is our skills, the people that are almost retiring, who have the skills. How are we going to go forward? Because I think if we don't start now, it's going to be absolutely too late. But we should have started a couple of years prior to this, where we've been training people to develop these skills. Now we might even have to be forced to import skills, because we haven't done this. So this is quite a concern. I think the other issue is municipalities. Municipalities have been an issue for many, many years. And we're seriously concerned, because the municipalities, the money they get in, at most of the time they don't use it for maintenance. They use it for other issues, the shortcomings in their revenues. And I think this is a really painful issue. And of course, municipalities, most of them, have employed consultants. And consultants have taken them to the cleaner. And they leave them high and dry, the money which they could use for bettering the municipality, to the notification, they're used to pay consultants. And the consultant gets their money and he says, okay, ta-ta, call me when you've got another packet of money and we'll come and advise you further. The electricity theft, you know, it's not only these informal settlements. There are businesses who have connected their wiring to bypass your meter, and they feed into their businesses. I think we should look at, and the only way you can see this is if you take the meter reading regularly, you'll see that the meter doesn't reflect from month to month as it should, because these things are actually happening, and these guys got the skills to do this. I think you made a very important point about council. You know, we sit there, you sit at the council, you take a decision on something you know nothing about. And how on God's earth do you think you can make this thing better? I really suggest that we should spend more money in educating counselors, or get a specific number of counselors to deal with the electricity and water and all those essential services. Because otherwise, we just check, the bloke comes in, he says, yes, vote, and votes yes, and he doesn't know what he's voting yes for. And I must say, lastly, is that I know it's always said that we are the cheapest in the world for electricity, but I must tell you, the people who are not working or who are getting a pittance for a salary or wage will not say this. Definitely it is expensive. I know, I come from a rural area. First of all, the levy that you're going to pay before you start getting your account. The first thing is the levy. And I thought you subtract that, but I failed. In a rural area, my house, I pay $1,000+ every month. And I look at my neighbor. How on God's earth are you going to make it, because you're not even employed?
Yeah, just a couple of questions. To latch on to the electricity theft thing, this goes to the Department of Energy. I know that the ministry is seized with the challenge of trying to have electricity defined as a crime, What's progress on that score? Are we making any headway? Because all the other things that we are trying to do are probably okay, but until we can actually accuse somebody of stealing electricity, we're not going to be able to stop that. With regard to free basic electricity, do we have a quantum? Do we know how much electricity goes to the communities, those indigents, on an annual basis that is given to them free, so that we are able to quantify exactly how much money is given away in this unconditional grant? And of course that can go to SAUGA or the ministry regarding that. And lastly, something was brought to my attention quite recently that someone who was owing the levies or rent or whatever people call it in the communities in the township wanted to go and buy electricity, prepaid electricity, and their account was blocked. That's the word they used. They were blocked so that they couldn't buy electricity, which meant that they were being actually punished because they were owing rent or services or levies. They wanted to go buy electricity, but they couldn't because they owe rent or they owe. Can that kind of thing be done? Why? It sounds to me like it's punishment for somebody who wants to go on with their lives.
Some of the things I've just read that I know well in your introduction you said we are just beginning a process that will take us some time. So further bridges are still going to address this. Like the department clarifying the issues related to policy provisions on matters of electricity distribution. That is the alternative to EDI. But also we will address in the future, I think, issues relating to skills. When Lucas was speaking, I thought when he spoke about skills, I thought he was going to talk about skills resulting from the closure of EDI. Because he was talking about EDI and he spoke about skills. Have we been able to do anything to retain those skills, or have we simply just said EDI is closed, these people can go? Issues of maintenance. It looks like this issue of maintenance is quite big. And the issue raised, I think, by SAUGA related to municipalities as distributors, the fragmentation, the number of service providers that become the alternative to EDI. That you're now talking hundreds and hundreds of municipalities, each of them with its own kind of power to determine prices. You know, that kind of fragmentation is a little bit clumsy. But those are issues I think that we will talk to later. And of course this leads us to the issue of a question of clarity to my friend from SAUGA in relation to the kind of benefits they think of from ESCOM. That if ESCOM generates and goes through down up to distributing to the households, the municipality gets nothing out of that. In a way, something comes to me to say it was EDI, now God, now it's ESCOM. Are we looking at a situation in future, and if I'm wrong, you'll correct me, in future where the municipalities now, fragmented as they are, want to take over ESCOM and deal with the replace the EDI? and they'll benefit from all the generation? Or are we talking about the issue of addressing the infrastructure problem, ensuring that municipalities are able to sell electricity directly to those people where at the current moment Eskom is now distributing? The other question would be actually more of a comment, in a way a question. You say this presentation, beautiful presentation by Salga, is talking more to the metros and urban areas. I have not heard if maybe I was doing something else. I apologize. But I have not heard much about rural municipalities. Rural municipalities and what happens in these rural areas. More especially not to rural municipalities, because even in a rural municipality you have a little town. I'm not talking about that little town. I talk about the rural villages down there, out there, where there's no town at all. They seem to be unfortunate and lost in the process, Malga. And I want to represent them. The point that I also wish to talk to is Salga raised the absence of qualified managers in various municipalities. Dr. Lucas raised sharply the issue of the use of consultants. Is it not time that we begin to appoint or to emphasize to municipalities the appointment of qualified managers in the who can do that job rather than appoint consultants? Maybe the point that you need to pick up sharply at Salga and begin to preach it to what municipalities to work out what that. I know there are financial problems, but I do not believe that the payment to your consultants is helpful. And I'll come back to this point in another form at a later stage. There are these areas, okay, the areas without electricity I've spoken to. But there is this question that I'm always raising wherever I get an opportunity about maintenance. I am of the view, Salga, and you either share or differ with me, you have the right to, that maintenance cannot be successfully attained through the use of tenders. I always argue that when you give me a tender, I come, I do what you ask me to do, and I go. But that problem of maintenance continues to remain. Is it not time that within municipalities we must begin to look at kinds of public works? I don't know what you would want to call them, the name does not matter. But where you can contract people for a particular period to deal with maintenance issues. It would also contribute, when I raised it in another committee, it was supported on the basis that it would also contribute towards our project of job creation. Rather than giving people, let me give an example of grass cutting. I have my own tractor and my grass cutter and my heavy. Then you hire me, I come and cut that grass. Right? It goes. And then I get someone to come and take that grass for his own cattle. But I can tell you in this rainy weather, 2 months down the line, that grass has grown again. Then it means we must get another one, give him a tender again. It doesn't seem to take us anywhere, does it? The issue of potholes, for instance. A lot of potholes get done, but after putting that patch, the big trucks come and pass there and take that bloody thing out. And you are left with back to square one. It's better if that is that kind of a maintenance job is contracted to a particular small company, for a period, say 2 years or 3 years, they or 10 years, whatever is reasonable, and they get responsible for everything there at a particular agreed amount of money. Maybe that is one of the things you need to look at. I would be happy to hear your comment on this particular one and the other I've raised earlier. Thanks, Chairperson.
It's time for the department and Falcon to make a comment. Over to you, gentlemen. A number of questions were addressed to us and start responding to them, not in the sequence they came, but from the end. The issue about retaining some of the skills from CDI coding itself, I was trying to check through how many full-time people are employed at CDI holding, but the number that keeps coming back to me is about 60 people, and a lot of the other stuff were actually consultants within CDI. And when I say permanent, it's also in relation to the 5-year contract that they implied. So basically we have contract people who had 5-year contracts, and then over and above that you had consultants who were doing specific projects. So it's not like you had any full-time employees there. But Chair, what our intention is relating to particularly the technical skills is to incorporate them into the program, into the ADAM program. So the idea is that the program will still continue with some of those EDI holdings technical people involved, albeit on a different employment condition. You know, the employment conditions are quite different between the public service and EDI holdings. So there is a plan to take advantage of that. Another question around the feasibility of using the exercise of the credit control. My political salary can also add to that, but it is a very hot issue. In fact, I think that there was a court case about 5 or so years ago, and I can't remember what the ruling was, but it was in respect of challenging whether if I owed money for this utility, my electricity could be cut off. Because if you recall, there are problems cutting off electricity, sorry, water, and you can only reduce it to a trickle, and what tends to happen is that, by and large, cutting off electricity is a very strong credit control measure. So, Chair, please, I'm trying to say that there is a legal principle that has been established in that regard. I just can't remember what the issue is, but I don't know if it gets used there, but it's quite a lot. And then the issue of the theft of electricity and an update in that regard. We have written to the Directorate of Public Prosecution, seeing that this is their mandate. Initially, we had thought that we would introduce an amendment into the Electricity Regulation Act to name it a specific crime, if you saw it. It's almost like bordering on economic sabotage. So table and stuff like that, but then our legal advice was that it is not our domain and that it was the Department of Justice, and we wrote to the Directorate of Public Prosecution to try and accentuate the problem and request them to not make it a general crime. I mean, if you still get it, it would be almost like this, but if you still have to work with the system, it's still then self-defense. It's not like installing 50 members of the system, but you black out the whole country and so on. So, those kind of issues. We still are waiting a response from that. And then the question around who ultimately will own the distribution assets and ESCOM going forward. It's in the Constitution, as I indicated. Schedule 4B currently read with other parts of the Constitution, making very clear that nobody but municipalities, so the local sphere of government has a mandate in that regard. So you cannot contemplate any other arrangement in relation to asset ownership. Municipalities own the distribution and infrastructure now, and unless the constitution changes, they will continue on this. What we, however, have is a legacy in terms of which I think around 1999, I can't remember when the old TV movie state. When Eskom took over this old TV state infrastructure, distribution infrastructure, it preceded the constitutional disturbation. And the question has now been raised as to whether Eskom needs to transfer it to the municipalities and what consideration. And by that, and I think my colleague from Carver also alluded to the problem. And now, on the one hand, Eskom says this is our asset, that is, we own it, irrespective of the constitution, and irrespective that the municipality has a particular mandate, and it makes the negotiation of service level agreements in terms of the municipality contract very difficult between Eskom and the municipality. We have not resolved that particular issue yet, but I think this is also indicate some of the complications that by and large Eskom cross subsidizes rural service provision. And if you were to transfer it to, for example, to a Bizana, just making Bizana better even bigger, because they will not have the economic base to cross subsidize and provide. So it's two sided. So on the one hand, you know, it definitely has fall foul of the philosophy in the constitution. On the other hand, the economic reality around transferring it and delivery implications of doing that. The question around the detail of the financing and whether involving or rather increasing the tariffs or not, like the chemical sector, so to speak, is a very difficult one, but there's a very simple reality there. Public financing in this context, two options only, nothing else. It's either the tariff or it's the tax. Right? As simple as that. So the argument becomes, where is it most appropriate to provide funding or to pay for the particular service? And it goes something like this, that everybody who uses the electricity service must pay the cost relating to the provision of the service. There are some people in this country who are taxpayers, but they are not electricity users. So is it fair to tax people in order to benefit the others that are using the electricity? We have 20% of unelectrified communities in this country, shall we say households in this country, who are taxpayers, may be taxpayers. Is it then fair to take their taxes and to put it into the electricity sector? Which then comes back to the other question now. If you do that, it means you're going to recover the money from the tariff. Unless if somebody has, you know, some other plan as to how this could be financed, that is the reality that we face. You could talk about loans, you could talk about all these other instruments, but ultimately it has to be repaid. So it boils down to, do you repay it from the tax or do you repay it from the tariff? And I think you have a sense what our preference would be, but obviously as you do that, then you also create other problems and consequences of speed tariff increases at the macroeconomic level, on the poor, and so on and so forth. But it's a very complex problem that we face in the country. The flip side of it obviously is that you can also do nothing about it. And if you don't do anything, then the consequences are there for everybody to see as well.
And I think that Maybe I should link that with the point being made about pre-basic electricity allocation being used for other things. I want to turn this around and ask you differently. In our view, the cost of provisions about the household in most municipalities is above the provision the household of pre-basic electricity. So it's impossible then to use that money for anything without providing any pre-basic electricity. The cost per unit, the cost per unit of providing are higher than the amount provided. So I just wanted to remove that point and then therefore suggest that where there are households that are getting electricity, that which has been provided for cannot be used for any other thing except it has to be subsidized over and above what comes from the national system. Then there was a question about pricing of water and waste. So that the burden of local provision does not rest on electricity and rate income only. So I think we need to look at this in the context of a typical household. Indeed, in the water sector, there is a pressure to say municipalities price appropriate water that we provide, increase tariffs. In the waste that the Department of Environmental Affairs is saying the same. In energy, we have seen 25% and above increases in terms of energy costs. Link that with increases in food prices, link that with increases in petrol prices. At the end of the day, the consumer sitting there will simply not afford to collect. That's the point that we're making across the board. That as we are doing all of these things, trying to make sure that each of these services is self-sustainable, it will be self-sustainable in the balance sheet. But most of that what which will be in the balance sheet will be better, because those consumers will simply not afford to pay. We do need to find a strategy of funding services to communities that does not completely rely on tariffs, or that doesn't assume that those services can and should be self-sustainable in terms of funding. We have tried to do this as a country over a period of time, and the consequence of that is that if you look at the municipal debt, every year it goes up, precisely because in the main consumers are not able to pay. So we keep recognizing this money that we've built in our book, but this money does not eventually come down to the municipality. And consequently, the supplier of the municipality, which is Eskom and Waterborne, do not get their money back. So if we do this, we will continue to hide a real problem of unaffordability of the by way of saying that we send you a bill, regardless of whether we'll afford it or not. We think we do need as a country to look at a different way of financing services that doesn't assume that it's possible, at least not in the country with our current economic reality, to be able to address that energy, where you have, in some cases, 90% of communities not able to pay. I mean, it's not simply being unemployed or being living in poor communities. It's not possible to do that. I hear the point raised by my colleague that what then do we do? I think that's what we need to really crack our heads and say, because otherwise we remain with this hidden in what they're hidden in cluster the provider debt. The other question was, do we have a problem with cross-subsidization? Certainly not. SALGA does not have a problem with cross-subsidization. In fact, in the water sector, we are implementing incentive block tariffs. What is the issue here is how the incentive block tariffs as proposed by NERSA would think that they have been designed best. It's a question of best design for an incentive block tariff to facilitate cross-subsidization that leads to undermine the sustainability of the service. Then the question was, what has happened when engaged with NERSA? To an extent, NERSA acknowledged these issues that were raising, but that for this year they want to insist on implementing the incentive block tariff as it is, and then in parallel with implementing that, engage in a process of reviewing it. So the damage for this year will be done. But then going forward, we hope that we'll find each other about how best then to deal with the cross-subsidization going forward. In part, we think that setting a benchmark across the country or across every area, regardless of the circumstances of consumer distribution, of consumer income distribution patterns, is the primary problem. So we do need to model an inclining block or a cross-subsidization formula that fits in with that particular area of distribution, where you look at what are the income distribution dynamics of that particular area, as opposed to using ESCOM and then rolling out a principle that means that we are copying the approval. But also links to that is to add on the other things that were part of the tariff in the first place, such as, for instance, fixed charges, or what we call as electricity charges. Future assets of EDI, I think my colleague from the department has responded to this, and I think in part I have also responded, but it's something that as part of rethinking the best way of structuring the industry may be impacted upon, because if we say, as colleagues in the state are doing, that let municipalities come together and form a municipal owned entity, those assets then remain to the municipality's assets. In other cases, there may be other solutions that may be found in terms of distribution, but constitutionally, municipalities have a responsibility in the process. That is in part why it was so hard to make sure that they give adequate compensation for assets that they have if those assets were to go to the rest. Use of electricity for credit control, I think just to add here that the precedent, the ruling was that municipalities should be able to do that. Where somebody owes a municipality for something else, credit control mechanism, which includes cutting electricity, could be applied. The cost of it that regard. But I think the logic of this is that in many of the services like water, like waste management and so on, if you were to say you have not paid for waste management, you are not collecting, the public health impact of that is much more bigger than the benefit of getting that person to collect, because they simply would have piles of waste accumulating, similar to water. Where you cut water, the public health impact becomes much bigger. So some of the services practically are not usable. You are not able to cut them as a result of non payment. So electricity becomes one of the or the main the service that you can actually use to enforce credit control by consumers. In fact, in our discussion as part of when there was discussion about the REIT, that was one of the issues that even when we have the REIT has to apply and to allow the municipality to actually cut electricity so that it can recover revenue for other things. Some resources such as Richard's Bay were indicating that if we don't have that, the impact on revenue collection will be so big for municipalities, because there will be no other option of enforcing credit control. So it's quite an important tool from the point of view of municipalities. What about rural areas? I think I thought I did talk about the rural areas when we were talking about the whole role that ESCOM is playing in this activity. Pretty much that whole talk is talking about what is happening in rural areas between municipalities and electricity distribution. The last one was about capacity in a municipality. This has been using consultants, this has been having long-term arrangements for service delivery. Let me start with the part that deals with capacity in municipalities and consultants. I think I agree with Honourable Member completely, and that's the point of wanting to push in the induction of councillors across. But what has happened not only in municipalities, we find it in provincial governments, I think we find it in national governments. We have tended to rely so much as a government on external service providers providing services to the municipality. I mean, we can go to a department, they'll tell us that to buy a soap, we have to go through a particular process of providers to provide. So I think there's been a shift in the past 20 years or so in the country in which government has completely relied on getting every bit of service from private sector. And in part, I think it has been instigated by the law that was put in terms of public finance management or municipal finance management, that we have really created this kind of but I think it should be possible with conscious leadership to say that you do need to have some capacity within the municipality to do these things. We are arguing the same thing about the roads, that in the road sector, what you find at best in most municipalities is an engineer who designs the contract, who manages the contract, even for maintenance. When one fixes potholes, you get a service provider to come and fix potholes. We think that we do need to move against that type now into where you have some limited capacity within the municipality. But linked to that is the overall long-term arrangement of service delivery. The Municipal Systems Act, Section 38, allows a municipality to establish long-term arrangements for external service provision. I think I want to be frank with the portfolio committee here. When we do our review in terms of service delivery in local government, this comes out as one of the major failings of local government leadership, establishing long-term arrangements for service delivery. We have said that when, even in water services, when we have said, okay, we want a water board or we want a company to provide services, we sign a short-term contract of 1 year and so on. So there's very few municipalities who can pick Joburg and others that have established institutions for managing service delivery that have got a long-term commitment to the municipality. We are raising this to local government leadership. It's something that is going to be to the Southern National Conference for the municipalities coming to say, at least in this year, in this term of local government, this is one thing that we must do wrong. Each municipality must sit back and say, what is the best way of managing services in my municipal area? Whether talking water, wastewater, electricity, and so on. And get into a program of establishing such mechanisms and make sure that it works. We have seen good examples that said that with Joburg we've done that. To an extent, services have been managed very well compared to other departments. In others, simply councillors came in for the department and then they said, okay, we'll continue with whatever was there as a department. So we do think that the priority that we need to act upon, not only in the area of electricity, but across service delivery in municipalities. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. I'll remember the end of the session. Unless I missed the answer, the professor also asked for the link of LinkedIn and 15 infrastructure. Who is responsible for that?
It is the funders.
The responsibility for maintenance of the infrastructure depends on who is the licensed distributor in that area. Where municipalities 178 are licensed distributors, they are responsible for maintenance, or they should be responsible for maintenance. Where ESCOM is a distributor that's licensed by NERSA, they should be responsible for maintenance of the infrastructure. I will ask you that way. But I think what we have said is to outline what then are the constraints to effective maintenance of the infrastructure within that country.
Just a start of website, the free banking alternative energy subsidy. At this stage in time, it says that 5% of households, some of them that have this, that enjoy this subsidy. My question is, assuming that it's because of the fact that this is still at a budget stage, what are the projections in the short term, given that today, you know, a number of initiatives, such as solar water heater, for example, and two other initiatives, you know, around the alternative energy, is it likely to grow at that rate, just in the short term? And there is not.
Just a quick one from my side, the last one. I mean, both of you have alluded to, and I'm referring to Osaga and the department, you have alluded to the challenges and negative implications of having a differentiated tariff structure. Eskom, for lack of a better way, Eskom charging less to the customer across the road is being serviced by the municipality is being very more. How are you going to address that challenge going forward? Because it's a serious one.
Thank you, Chair. Just a quick one. I just picked up something that was said when Sanga was presenting. What is the relationship or let me put it this, what is ESCOM's demeanor? Yeah, that's much better. What's ESCOM's demeanor vis-a-vis SALGA and what's NERSA's demeanor vis-a-vis SALGA? I just got a feeling that they don't seem to take SALGA seriously as an entity that they need to take seriously when it approaches them.
Thank you, Chief. Just a quick one. Thank you, Chair. Yes, the license authority is the municipality where they are responsible, and Eskom where they are the license authority, they're responsible for the maintenance. And then we get the constraints. But when you find municipalities that's dysfunctional or hasn't got the capacity to do the maintenance, how do they do then, what plan do they have in mind in outsourcing this maintenance issue? Is it done through the IDP, Integrated Development Plan of municipalities? Do they then said yes, we're not able to do it, but we outsource this competency to ESCOM to do it, to get to some sort of maintenance in especially dysfunctional municipalities?
Okay, gentlemen. So if I can try and respond to the liquid air problem, because that's the companies that are involved. One French, one British, in the same jurisdiction, and the same industry and computer release in China. It's a quite frankly, we have not addressed this particular issue at this point, because it requires a redesign of municipal tariffs. I think, as we have heard today, what it means is that there's a number of competing interests that you have to take into account. If you change the tariff on the one hand, you might create an imbalance in the municipal revenues. You know, on the other hand, you have another distortion in the economics of providing industrial air. So we were hoping that as part of the process of EDI restructuring, we have not done any justice to the chair in here, that ultimately all of these distribution tariffs have to be aligned with the principles established in the electricity pricing policy, because we're saying firstly one needs to do a cost of supply study before you can get to. You have to understand what you're trying to recover, and those costs have to be justified.
alternatively that it is not a real cost, it is just an inefficiency that we need. So, Soche, what I'm trying to say is that you cannot address it in a more direct way than a holistic reappraisal of the way that a municipality charge and design the tariffs, but also side by side with the fiscal framework for municipalities. Because I think what we also heard today was that you know, on the one hand you could have a viable electricity industry and unviable municipality. At the moment what we have is perhaps slightly more viable municipality and unviable distribution industry. So it's a lot deeper. I think that question is very, very profound, Chair. And if you resolve that problem, then you will just solve the South African distribution issue. What happened is that they complained to NERSA. NERSA tried to address the issue, and then obviously NERSA's jurisdiction stops at a certain point where the municipal constitutional competency takes over. So, that's the answer to the problem. Prognosis regarding the 5% of three basic opportunities. And maybe just to explain that, what we're indicating is that if we had 100 people who qualify to get free basic electricity, we are confident that 70 of them are getting free basic electricity and 5 are getting free basic alternative energy, which is like 75% penetration level. What we're saying is that we're not so sure that the 25% out there that qualifies for free basic electricity or even free basic alternative electricity are in there in the net, so to speak. So the challenge is that should these people fall within areas which do not have infrastructure, then the 5% will increase to cover those that are in the rural areas without any infrastructure. Should they fall within areas where the infrastructure is in place, then they will increase on that 70% that we have indicated. And I think also this is a concept that we have not done a recent assessment of the leakage. In other words, what percentage of that funding goes to those that do not qualify to receive, those that are already or rather not in indigent. Chair, as you can appreciate, it's a very dynamic thing. It's not like when you're indigent now, you are indigent forever. You know, people move in and out of it. So I think it was just a sort of indication, but we suggested that rather have those that qualify in the net than outside of the net, and then have, you know, a different challenge where there's leakage. What we have at the moment is that those that should be in the net are not in the net. Some 20%, 25% of them should be in the net, are not in the net. And those that should, I mean, me and you, well, I come from Victoria, I am in the net, but I have a job. And also it's those kind of the complexities where I've been subsidized the first so many minutes, and it costs, hey, million then to the municipality, where the funding could be better deployed elsewhere. So that's the long answer to each other. Yeah. Thank you.
I have maybe I should just make a quick comment related to this thing of the mechanism of cross-subsidization. I think what we find is, in general, the assumption from various sector departments when they are talking about channeling from the colleague.
Can Honorable Lucas touch the chalk?
Thank you. Thanks. There is an assumption that the only way of targeting the poor in respect of providing free basic services is an indigent register. But what we have found in some of the municipalities is that administering an indigent register, in some cases, it costs so much that it becomes prohibitive, that you have to
in, you say some people will differentiate from themselves in terms of their income by their consumption. If you consume this much, the first block, you are likely to be safe. You won't pay for it. But when you consume first block, second block, and third block, it is those second, third, and fourth, and fourth block where they exist. They are charged at a rate in such a way that we recoup what could have been your subsidy in the first block. So in effect, there isn't a subsidy when you look at the total bill that goes to that person. That's what the city of Joburg is implementing, as opposed to an indigent policy. Because to have to try and administer an indigent policy to cost millions to the city of Joburg just because of the size of the indigents that are there. So they have decided to use consumption as a way of targeting the poor. Others are targeting the poor by geographical area. To say it's unlikely that in that informal settlement there will be someone who could afford. If there will, the likely is that the era will see a much more era of exclusion than the era of inclusion if we were to give everyone in that informal area free basic services, which is what my colleague is talking about. So in deciding on how to target the poor for free basic services, we look at what would work better as a strategy vis-a-vis is the era of inclusion or era of exclusion that goes with that particular strategy. We know that a lot of departments have insisted that administer an indigenous register, and we've made this point to say not always an indigenous register is the best way of targeting the poor to provide free services. The other point that I just want to comment on is the inequitable treatment of customers. I think Ombias has made this point quite eloquently, but just to demonstrate this, that it will not be possible to resolve the problem of those two businesses across the road without rethinking the structure of the industry, is that in the case of Eskom, which charges that business 40% less than the other, Eskom does have a big percentage of big businesses that it is collecting revenue from. One, this has been the proportion of the poor that it subsidizes. Ebrulen municipality is in a different situation compared to Eskom. That's the first part. Linked to that is that Eskom does not have to pay some, does not have to contribute to the provision of service, other services by the municipality of Ebrulen. All its money is ring-fenced into the distribution industry. But Ebrulen, over and above covering the cost of providing and the cost of subsidizing within the sector, it's got a responsibility to cross-subsidize other services of the municipality. So by design, then, getting electricity from a municipality is supposed to be more expensive than getting electricity from Eskom, unless you solve the problem of the fiscal framework of local government, in which the provision of other services is not dependent on electricity, which is currently the current design. And secondly, where the consumer base of a municipality can be comparable to the consumer base of Eskom in terms of income distribution. At the moment, those two things are not comparable. That leads to that. So the point being made by my colleague that it's embedded in the structural issues of the industry. The only way to resolve them is through resolving those structural issues, is a point that I'm emphasizing. The demeanor of NERSA and Eskom towards Zalga. Let me start with NERSA. We have made this point to NERSA. We hope things will change in the future. We get a sense that NERSA tended to position itself to be a regulator of Eskom. In its processes, in its systems, in its timelines, and so on, it's pretty much the regulator of generation, the regulator of, to an extent, of transmission, but pretty much it puts all of its efforts and philosophy towards regulating Eskom. In the distribution industry, where we have Eskom as just one of the 178 distributors, then that means that the regulation does not work as effectively because the others are not really the focus. NERSA deals with them as and when they are applying for basis with an engagement with ESCOM, we are, with NERSA, and we are hopeful that now that the CEO of NERSA is somebody who understands the distribution industry as much as Pindile does, we think that there should be a shift in terms of focus of NERSA to recognize that there is ESCOM, which is a huge animal that must be regulated and regulated effectively, but there's also 176 distributors that are municipalities that must be regulated and regulated effectively. We think that there should be a shift there. With regards to ESCOM, the relationship between ESCOM and SALGA as an association, I would say it is okay. However, the relationship between ESCOM and municipalities, which are members of the association, is a problematic one, in our view, in that ESCOM doesn't see itself being, in a sense, in the areas of operations where municipalities have a jurisdiction, being really informed by the priorities of the municipalities. We all the time get feedback from municipalities that our development plans are undermined by the attitude of ESCOM. ESCOM will say, look, we have designed our infrastructure and this is how it goes. If you wanted to focus on area A, B, C, and D, unfortunately our plan goes to D and F. So you have to find a way to retrofit to what we're doing. So that's currently the attitude. It's something that, which is why we're saying to ESCOM, rather there must be service level agreements with each of the municipalities where ESCOM is a distributor and which ESCOM is not buying into. So there are issues in terms of the relationship, particularly at a local level. We are hoping to use these cordial relations with SALGA to try and resolve that to the benefit of municipalities. Maintenance outsourcing, that was the last question. Firstly, the legislation, the Municipal Finance Management Act, or sort of the Municipal Systems Act, allows for municipalities to appoint, as I said, long-term service providers. It could be ESCOM. In fact, the bias of the legislation is that you must explore public service providers. If you are in the water sector, first look at the water boards, look at ESCOM in the electricity sector, and then decide. So each of the, what this drive that we're talking about that we want to implement now with the new councillors to say, we must resolve this, is in part trying to do that. So each municipality must honestly look at its capacity and say, can we deliver this service internally? If not, let's look at the best external option that would work in our area. It's an area that is in the hands of councillors. They cannot blame anyone for having it been, for it not having been done. And this current crop of councillors, we would like them to commit to try and resolve that matter during this term of council.
Thank you very much, gentlemen, both from the department and SALGA. This has been quite helpful, and I hope it's going to trigger more questions than answers to us. However, one would like to make a couple of comments. Provision of energy is quite a complex matter, as we see, ever since the advent of the Department of Energy being standalone, with that electricity being the 90%, or the 95% of our energy comes from electricity. One observes that we're beginning to unravel and identify areas where there are bottlenecks, such as this one, that of distribution, and it's impact. At the end of the day, not only on access but also on utilization, because I'm sure all of this do that impact at the end of the day. However, as we go along, there are a few things that we need to receive and address ourselves so that when we meet again or in whatever platform where we interact, we should do our best to address them. I was scribbling a few questions, so I don't want them to be answered, because one of the things I ask myself, does the department have the same or similar analysis as that of SALGA, just for starters? The players are here. Of course,
goes further, whatever those who are not here, a lot of mention is made about NASFA, you know, ESCOM. I suppose one of the things we need to be quite clear is who exactly are the real players in the distribution sector, as well as the sector that handles the infrastructure networks on electricity. And are they working together? It doesn't seem so. And it's obvious that, you know, as a committee representative of Parliament or the National Assembly, we need to work together with the NCOP in particular and even the rest to ensure that we address these matters. A very good reference has just been made about the, you know, the bizarre, you know, set of relations. ESCOM having good relations with SALCA, and ESCOM not having good relations with some of the municipalities. I'm sure not all of them, but some. But how does that happen? Because the very municipalities constitute SALCA at the end of the day. So why couldn't there have been SALCA been a platform to address this, you know, all the time? But I'm just throwing, you know, things on the table just to indicate that the committee was right that and spot on that. We said, look, this is a start. We definitely, as I speculate, that when we have a couple of meetings or whatever forms of interactions in future, we have to pull in the other role players as well. It doesn't have to be meetings all the time, you know. I'm sure the committee will have to look at other forms. It could be public hearings, it could be just pulling a panel of experts, it could be whatever. But what is fundamental is that we have a role to play. And let me just remind as well that the NCOP Select Committee is still expecting us to interact with them on this matter as well. Hopefully that will shed and some more light and add value to this. It's obviously worth mentioning that the Free State model is something worth pursuing, because it seems to be one of its kind, but of course we'll enter into that domain quite carefully and cautiously. One cannot overlook and even commend, of course, the both SALCA and the department that they didn't just come and present what they see as problems and challenges, but they've also displayed that they've been trying their earnest to propose or be embroiled or seized with solutions. And I trust us and hope then the committee, either on its own as well as together with the NCOP Select Committee on Economic Development, we take a deeper look at those solutions and see how it responds, you know, as we go along this path towards an appropriate conclusion of this you know, challenge in the distribution sector. I'm sure at this stage in time, we can thank both the Department of Energy as well as SALCA for the valuable input they've made. And furthermore, I will invite members, you know, to further, you know, go through the presentations that have been made. If there are any areas where you need further information, please do so. I'll be very glad to facilitate. I don't want to rush this either. It's very complex. You can also sense from the very questions we've been asking, you know, that it's not the first time we've been exposed to them, but, you know, it's a balance of understanding this sector developmentally as well as technically. Of course, we're not technical people. We've got to understand the distribution sector more developmentally than anything. And of course, there might be areas where down the line may even have to look at you know, exploring the legislative changes to tighten things. I've sensed that the South Ombi, you know, one way or another was saying, and also even that Sokala, not in so many ways, you know. So there's a lot on our plate regarding this. And once again, let me thank both gentlemen, and let us then move to other items in our meeting, which will not take long for now. Honourable members, another quick case is the strategic plan for the portfolio committee. If you remember, during the third week of April, we had a meeting of with an intensive 4-day session in Stellenbosch. The first was 2 days of training, which I still expect a summary report on that, so that we can be able to see what key issues can still person maintain. And I actually thought I would be having that circulated here, just for some legacy for us to keep as we move along. The second 2 days was a strategic plan, not necessarily from as an initial exercise, because this was done in 2009, but according to the directives of the National Assembly, we're supposed just to refine ours. A draft has been circulated, and I would draw the attention of members to the fourth section in particular, because that's where the core of the program is. The first session, three core objectives, strategic objectives, values and policies of Parliament, is nothing else but you know, cut and paste issues. It creates the framework. It shows us what drives us, what informs us. You know, where do we draw all the nitty gritties that we find at the end of the day in the fourth section, which is the core of the document, the actual program itself. And then at the end, the fifth section, which is operational procedures. Also, that one is just about to say, now that we have a core program, you know, what guides us within the parliament procedures, you know, in terms of legislation, in terms of public hearings, in terms of just meetings, in terms of oversight visits, and all of that. I'm raising this because I would like you to, when you read, you know, the document, you read it in that way, or otherwise it might be a little bit, you know, complex. So it's actually the first question that I would draw your attention, appeal that you look at it, consult others, and at the end of the day, we'll target, I think it's around 14th of June, to finalize and to conclude it. It therefore means that in between, please push yourself a little bit hard, that in the next week, make all comments, submit them, so that we can refine and conclude such that on the 14th of June, we all are together to just conclude the plan and submit it. Now, having said that, given that it's a document that has taken some time, I wouldn't mind if need be from time to time, if any of you can pick up a phone, try to get an explanation here and there. Please bear with us if there are grammatical errors. You know, we all had to do this deep at night. So definitely there could be those few grammatical errors. Help us to do that proofreading. But otherwise, one can say, by and large, the core of the document has been sorted out. I think one can explain just a little bit if one looks at the core program. What we have tried to do is to try and articulate in the main activities that are guided by the strategic objectives. Now, if you remember, one of the things we did in Stellenbosch was to refine the strategic objectives, which are about 15, about 15 of them. So what then the program says is that in view of those strategic objectives, what are the broad activities that we would like to take up in each and every one of those activities, whether it's review of energy policies, whether it's climate change, whether it's looking at energy efficiencies, whether it's looking at the entities themselves. However, I think that's a caution. There may be a little bit of a complexity here, because whilst looking at those strategic objectives, we also are saying that in terms of the Parliament's core function, now Parliament itself, the five core functions, how does each of these strategic objectives get implemented? There's legislation, there's oversight, there's public participation, there's the international work, there's also cooperative government. So you may find at times each strategic objective repeated, you know. Please mustn't confuse, because it's like saying that if you are reviewing energy policy, how would we do it under legislation? But how would we do it under oversight? Because we still have to go and do oversight, still on energy policy. How would we do it in terms of public participation, where we interact with the public, getting their views on it? And how would we do it on international issues, where we interact with our counterparts, whether it's SADC or even in a global platform? So please take your time and look into that. But also, please remember, I think somewhere we've tried to explain that. Once again, this is more or less like a Bible or Quran, because at the end of the day, our term-based programs are going to be informed by it. You know, when we go to each program, each term, in the four terms in each year, we'll then draw from it and use it to ensure that we are able to cover our work as our committee, as the National Assembly is directing us. Let me not bore you much, because the crux of the matter is to go through the document. As I say, much more than anything, Section 4, that of the core program. The last one is the minutes. Now, I see that. Do we all have copies of minutes? No. I want to express my high level of dissatisfaction. You know, when I looked at these minutes, they are minutes of February. You know, they were just on the 31st of May. Of course, I take part of the blame for that. Maybe I should be a bit more strict in this, because it's very obvious, you know. How do you remember minutes of the 9th and the 22nd of February in May? All I can undertake is to make sure that we'll get these minutes tabled, you know. In fact, they have to be circulated before our next meeting next week, so that you go through them, and then we can adopt them next week. For now, I think we are done. Thank you very much for your attendance, and I'm sure now we can be able to go to the extended public meetings in the afternoon. I don't know which ones that were, but thanks a lot. Thank you. Let's all have an excuse to have a full day meeting.